Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice on WSCA LP Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, May 14th, 2005. Our focus is on global connections. We'll hear from two New Hampshire activists who have recently traveled abroad with peace and justice delegations. In our first hour, we'll hear Damon Thomas interview Michael Murray, who has just returned from a conference in Cuba about trade issues. We'll also have music and commentary. In our second hour, Tom Jackson interviews Ann Miller, who is recently back from a delegation to Iran. We'll also have announcements, activist history, and more music. First, let's go to Jeff White with some news.
Good afternoon, and welcome to News with Making Waves. Vice President Dick Cheney didn't have to disclose the advice his energy task force got from the industry. An appeals court ruled Tuesday in what was probably the final blow to a politically charged lawsuit over public access to White House decision-making. The task force met in 2001 and produced pro-industry recommendations for sweeping energy legislation now before Congress. The Bush administration fought hard to keep the panels working secret, arguing the public disclosure would make it difficult for any White House to solicit candid advice on important policy issues. Once seen as a potentially huge political liability for the Bush administration, the task force lawsuit ended up being more Washington political theater, with cameo appearances by Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia and former Enron Corp Chairman Ken Lay. The two private groups that sued failed to establish that the government had a legal duty to produce documents detailing the White House's industry contacts, the court said in an 8-0 decision. The Sierra Club and Judicial Watch alleged that energy executives and lobbyists effectively became members of the task force, while environmental groups and others were shut out of the meetings. Outside participation made the task force a federal advisory committee with an obligation to disclose its operations, the groups argued, a position the court rejected. David Bookbinder, a senior attorney at the Sierra Club, said the decision is not going to be helpful in assuring open and accountable government. Cheney's task force issued a report that favored expanding oil and gas drilling on public land, rejuvenating nuclear power, and lifting the ban on drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. Scalia took a hunting trip with Cheney while the Supreme Court was considering an appeal of the lawsuit. Scalia then issued a forceful defense, rejecting calls for him to step aside and let the other eight justices rule. Democrats hoped the Supreme Court would uphold an earlier ruling by the appeals court and force the administration to reveal potentially embarrassing details about its relationship with energy company executives ahead of the November election. But the high court sent the case back on a 7-2 vote, saying there was, quote, a paramount necessity of protecting the executive branch from vexatious litigation. Ken Lay was involved because he met with Cheney, a fact the White House acknowledged to Congress in 2002, only after Enron collapsed in scandal. Lay's contact was among six meetings between Enron executives and Cheney or his task force aides. The day after the meeting with Lay, Cheney said the Bush administration would not support price caps on wholesale energy sales in California. This story also from the Associated Press. Shouting death to America, more than 1,000 demonstrators rioted and threw stones at a U.S. military convoy Wednesday as protests spread to four Afghan provinces over a report that interrogators desecrated Islam's holy book at the U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay. Police fired on the protesters, many of them students, trying to stifle the biggest display of anti-American anger since the ouster of the ruling Taliban militia 3.5 years ago. There were no reports of American casualties, but the violence left four dead and 71 injured in Jalalabad, a city 80 miles east of the capital of Kabul. Mobs smashed car and shop windows and attacked government offices, the Pakistani consulate and the offices of two UN agencies in Jalalabad. Smoke billowed from the consulate in a UN building. The protests may expand into neighboring Pakistan, where a coalition of hardline Islamic parties said it would hold nationwide demonstrations this past week over the alleged desecration of the Quran. Many of the 520 inmates in Guantanamo are Pakistanis and Afghans captured from the September 11th attacks. Despite both governments' support of the U.S.-led war on terrorism, suspicion lingers in the conservative Muslim nations about the American military. Growing urban unrest could pose another security challenge for the U.S.-backed Afghan government, which is already battling a strengthening Taliban insurgency. About 18,000 U.S. troops are in Afghanistan, fighting rebels and searching for Taliban and al-Qaeda leaders, including Osama bin Laden. The source of the anger was a brief report in the May 9th edition of Newsweek that interrogators at Guantanamo placed Qurans on toilets to rattle suspects, and in at least one case flushed a holy book down the toilet. An Afghan opposition leader claimed the demonstration reflected frustration at the role of the United States and Karzai's plans for military ties, which could include long-term U.S. bases. Karzai is the current president of Afghanistan. This from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Last month, Army recruiters fell 42% short of their goal, according to the Army Recruiting Command. Those numbers are ominous. If they continue in the months to come, as seems likely, they threaten not merely our ability to stick it out in Iraq, but also the Army's long-term ability to perform its duties worldwide, according to Jay Bookman. And the reason for that decline is obvious. In April of 2003, around the anniversary of the fall of Baghdad, 73% of Americans believed the war was worthwhile. Only 23% did not, according to a CNN Gallup poll. So recruiters had little trouble filling their quotas. Today, though, only 40% of Americans believe the war was worthwhile, while nearly 60% believe it was not. And if Americans do not believe the war was worthwhile, they're not likely to sign up to fight it. As a result, we now find ourselves in a very grim race. As former Pentagon Comptroller Dov Zakheim described the situation in a recent panel discussion in Washington, quote, "Will we become wary before the insurgents become wary?" Or as North Vietnamese leader Ho Chi Minh supposedly said, "You kill 10 of our men and we will kill one of yours, and in the end it will be you who will tire of it." This is a bad situation. If we are forced to leave Iraq before a stable government takes hold there, the consequences would be enormous, and our leaders understand that. Even now, despite the polls, it's striking that no major leader of either party has publicly suggested anything but sticking it out. At some point, though, that's going to change. On an issue like this, the public eventually leads and the leaders follow. Top secret British documents recently leaked to the British press may explain why this change will happen. The primary document is an internal summary of a meeting held on July 23, 2002, by British Prime Minister Tony Blair and a handful of his top foreign policy, intelligence, and military advisors. At that point, most Americans had no idea the war with Iraq was even being considered, but apparently Blair and President Bush had agreed to invade Iraq as far back as an April 2002 meeting in Crawford, Texas. In the July meeting, Blair and his aides discussed the American plan to create an international crisis around Iraq and its weapons of mass destruction. The idea was to set the stage for war by demanding that Saddam Hussein readmit UN weapons inspectors. When Saddam refused, that would be an excuse to invade. However, as British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw told Blair in that July meeting, the case is thin. Saddam was not threatening his neighbors, and his WMD capability was less than that of Libya, North Korea, or Iran. Blair was also told that the most likely timing in U.S. minds for military action to begin was January, with a timeline beginning 30 days before the U.S. congressional elections. That description is damning, indicating the Bush administration cynically manipulated its war plans to create maximum political advantage for Republican congressional candidates. The document's most devastating paragraph, however, summarizes a report by the head of British intelligence known as C. C has just returned from meetings in Washington, and he's telling Blair what he learned there. Quote, "Bush wanted to remove Saddam through military action, justified by the conjunction of terrorism and WMD, C tells Blair. But the intelligence and the facts were being fixed around the policy. There was little discussion in Washington of the aftermath after military action. The intelligence was being fixed." So yes, a nation can be fooled into war by its own leaders. We've learned that much, but unless the war is short and successful, there's a price to be paid, according to Jay Bookman. In this case, what began as an optional war has morphed into a war of great importance, but now, when our leaders tell us that, fewer Americans believe them, and fewer still are willing to die for it. And this story is from the Associated Press. South America and Arab leaders at their first regional summit endorsed a declaration Wednesday condemning the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory and calling for trade liberalization to lift the planet's poor out of misery. Banding together an event aimed at dampening the dominance of developed countries, They ended the two-day summit of South American and Arab countries by staking out positions at odds with U.S. policy on several fronts while committing to closer political and economic ties for the two far-flung regions. For me, this meeting marks the beginning of a new historical moment in our relations, said Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, the summit's host. The relationship between South America and the Arab countries will never be the same again. Venezuelan leader Hugo Chavez, a socialist and American-backed Iraqi President Jalal Talabani, joined dozens of other nations in approving a declaration of Brasilia, condemning terrorism, denouncing U.S. sanctions against Syria, and supporting moves to give developing countries more clout on the international stage. The summit brought 9,000 troops to the Brazilian capital in the tightest security seen in years. Pushing a goal he has pursued since becoming the country's first elected leftist leader, Silva urged participants to fight for free trade rules that help the developing world instead of benefiting only rich countries and multinational corporations. While the leaders stressed commitment to protect intellectual property rights, a key U.S. issue, the declaration said intellectual property protection should not prevent developing countries from access to basic science to technology. Brazil has repeatedly threatened to break patents on AIDS drugs produced by big multinational companies. The United States has complained that Brazil and other countries are not doing enough to stop rampant pirating of everything from software to DVDs that are supposed to be protected by law. Arab states, under pressure from Washington to reform their authoritarian regimes, chose to focus their energy on the Palestinian crisis. The declaration calls for tighter political and economic links between the regions, but demands that Israel disband settlements and retreat to its borders before the 1967 Mideast War. In all, 7 of 22 Arab heads of state attended, while 8 of the 12 South American leaders came to Brasilia. The United States requested to attend as an observer, but Brazil refused to allow that. I can't imagine why. This story from the Boston Globe. The United States is seeking to use a major UN conference on nuclear nonproliferation to highlight the dangers of North Korea and Iran, but has been undermined by allegations from some developing countries that Washington itself has backtracked on commitments to reduce its nuclear arsenal, according to UN diplomats and delegates to the conference. 1 week into the four-week conference, delegates have failed to agree on an agenda, while the United States insists on focusing on the threat of rogue states and terrorist groups. In developing countries insist on talking about unfulfilled U.S. pledges. The conference is aimed at strengthening the landmark 1970 Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, widely considered to be the world's most important arms control blueprint. Nearly every nation in the world has signed on. Three that haven't, Pakistan, India, and Israel, have either acquired nuclear weapons or are believed to have done so. The U.S. efforts have been frustrated by a bloc of developing countries led by Egypt that have insisted the gathering should also address U.S. disarmament pledges. The United States is under fire for what some nations see as violations of agreements made under the Non-Proliferation Treaty of 1995 and 2000 to dismantle some of its weapons. In preparatory meetings with other countries before this year's conference, the Bush administration distanced itself from those commitments, refused to sign on to an agenda for the conference that explicitly referenced past pledges, saying those commitments were not binding. That assertion alarmed many arms control advocates. And this from the New York Times Company, my favorite pick of the week. By electing Steve Nash, the NBA's most valuable player, the pro basketball media made the day of everyone who plays hoops on Friday and protests the U.S. war machine on Saturday. First and foremost, Steve Nash deserved this award. He averaged a league-leading 11.5 assists a game and shot 50%. Beyond statistics, the 6-foot-tall Canadian point guard led the Suns to one of the greatest turnarounds in NBA history. After signing as a free agent from the Dallas Mavericks, Nash grabbed the Suns and yanked them from a terrible 29 wins to an NBA-leading 62. Nash barely won the MVP, edging out Miami Heat center Shaquille O'Neal in a squeaker. His victory shocked some observers because it's Shaq who fits in with the NBA's marketing strategy of pushing forward individual superstars at the expense of team play. Nash, on the other hand, invited all his Phoenix Sun teammates up to the podium with him when he accepted the MVP. Now, you might be wondering why I'm reading a sports story. Well, you're about to find out. In electing Nash, they have thrown, whether intentionally or not, both spotlight and glory on someone who is an early and vocal resistor to the U.S. occupation of Iraq. Nash was the first high-profile athlete to come out against Dick Cheney's War of a Generation, showing up at a 2003 All-Star game wearing a t-shirt that read, "Shoot baskets, not people." When questioned on his incendiary attire, Nash said, "I think war is wrong in 99.9% of all cases. I think Operation Iraqi Freedom has much more to do with oil or some other sort of distraction." He also showed far more wisdom than Bush, Cheney, Colin Powell, or Condoleezza Rice, saying, "I think that Saddam is a crazy dictator. I don't think he's threatening us at this point in time." Nash also took issue with the pro-war media, 2 years before the New York Times and the Washington Post were forced to issue apologies for their slavish, slothful pro-war coverage. Nash said, "I think a lot of what we hear in the news is misleading and flat-out false. So I think it's important for us to think deeper and find out what is really going on." He didn't backpedal from this stance despite criticism from his boss at the time, Mavericks owner Mark Cuban and Spurs center David Robertson, who also said, "If it's an embarrassment to Nash, maybe he should live in a different country." For the basketball media to honor a serious anti-war voice like Nash is cause for celebration. And that's the news with Making Waves, and go out and make some waves. Thank you.
Yo no soy Inca capitán, hace tiempo lo fui. Deje que vuelva para el sur, déjeme ir allí. Deje que vuelva para el sur, déjeme ir allí. Mi nombre casi lo olvidé, Dorotea Bazán. Yo no soy Inca, India soy, por amor, capitán. Yo no soy Inca, India soy, por amor, capitán. Me falta el aire pampa y el olor de los ranqueles campamentos, el cobre oscuro de la piel de mi señor. En imperio de gramilla, cuero y sol. Usted se asombra, capitán, que me quiere volver. Un alarido de malón me reclama la piel. Un alarido de malón me reclama la piel. Yo me hice india y ahora estoy más cautiva que ayer. Quiero quedarme en el dolor de mi gente ranquel. Quiero quedarme en el dolor de mi gente ranquel. Me falta el aire pampa y el olor de los ranqueles campesinos. campamentos, el cobre oscuro de la piel de mi señor. En ese imperio de gramilla, cuero y sol. Quiero quedarme en el dolor de mi gente ranquera.
That was Mercedes Sosa with Dorotea La Cautiva. We now go to an interview with Michael Murray, who is a local activist just returning from a conference in Cuba. He went with a Witness for Peace delegation and focused a lot on trade issues, as he will tell you about.
Good afternoon and welcome to another interview segment here on Making Waves. My name is Damon Thomas and I'll be hosting this portion of the program. Today's discussion is one that you will not find anywhere else in your radio dial, and I encourage all of our listeners to stay tuned and to become informed as I speak with local activist Michael Murray. Michael was part of a delegation from Witness for Peace who just returned from an important conference in Cuba about CAFTA and free trade policies in the Americas. Michael brings with him his first-hand accounts from an event that Americans need to know about, not only from the point of view of the importance to us of all the issues raised at the conference, but also because the events of the conference, if they were reported here at all, were presented in a most distorted fashion by a cynical and negligent mainstream press here in the United States. Michael, welcome to Making Waves, and thank you for taking the time to be here.
Hi, thank you very much.
First off, a little bit of background. Can you tell us how it was that you came to be in Cuba, what the conference was about, and who was at the conference and when it was?
Yeah, this was my second delegation to Cuba. I went last summer and went to Chiapas, Mexico for half of the delegation, and the other half was in Cuba assessing the impact of the embargo that the United States has had against Cuba for 46 years. A little history about Witness for Peace. They began in 1984 during the Nicaraguan Sandinista war that was going on down there, the Contras. And the Witness for Peace delegates realized every time they were in Nicaragua that the violence would cease. So they thought if they made a longer presence of themselves, that in the long run the violence would ultimately stop. And that was the beginning of Witness for Peace. They have since grown into Mexican situations where they are combating NAFTA and CAFTA. And they're also working in Colombia, dealing with the Colombian plan that the U.S. government has put in place. And so it's Cuba, it's Colombia, Mexico, and Nicaragua. Those are the four countries that Witness for Peace is involved with right now. And this particular delegation that I just went to was for a conference for the free trade area of the Americas. And this conference involved every country in the hemisphere was represented. Every single country in South America, Central America, of course North America were there. And we were all there to discuss the impact that NAFTA and CAFTA is having on all these countries. It is very devastating to the farmers in all these countries where they are being moved off of their land for the corporations to build factories, to turn these people into factory workers, which is against their cultural sustainability. And it's very difficult for them to learn how to now become a factory worker instead of what they have done for thousands of years in growing corn and various other vegetables.
I'm wondering if you could give our listening audience some insight into what NAFTA and CAFTA are. I know they stand for acronyms for North American Free Trade Agreement and likewise, but if you could just expound on those two trade agreements for a moment, just to share some background as to what the agreements call for And I'd like to assess the impact of those agreements as well on the people you mentioned. But first off, if you could give the audience some idea of what these agreements embody, what they entail, what, and why some of the provisions are so objectionable to many of the folks in these countries.
Well, the NAFTA agreement was signed by President Clinton back in the 90s, and it was the North American Free Trade Agreement, which involves Canada, United States, and Mexico. And what it entails is that corporations from the U.S. and or Canada can and will, and they do, travel down to Mexico, where they displace the indigenous population. They have them move off of their land by means of the Mexican army. Again, I mentioned earlier that they make them become now factory workers, which is something that they really have no idea how to do since they've been planting corn for thousands of years. NAFTA hurts the American workers since they lose their jobs when the factories are relocated to Mexico. Once they get to Mexico, the farmers are dislocated to another area, and they're losing their cultural sustainability. They work for a very, very low, inhumane wage, many hours. There is no labor unions, no health care, and there are very, very strict rules that the corporations, if they pollute the certain area that their factories are located in, the government, such as Mexico, has no legal right to sue this corporation. So they go down to these villages, they set up their factories. There are very limited environmental laws which they have to follow. So they don't follow any. They pollute the water, they pollute the air, they pollute the food sources.
It seems that even with the presence or the existence of any such laws, that they can effectively circumvent them by way of this agreement, where prosecution under these laws just doesn't happen. It's a nullity because of the agreement itself. The agreement almost supersedes local or national environmental laws and regulations, as well as labor laws, if I'm hearing you correctly.
That's absolutely true. That's part of the agreement signed by these corporations. They won't go into another country unless they are assured that they cannot be sued by this country. There is also another clause in the agreement that states that the corporations themselves can sue that particular country if there is any violation of their future income. For instance, in Costa Rica, in the CAFTA situation, which is the Central American Free Trade Agreement, they backed out of their agreement about drilling oil offshore, and this irritated the corporations, so they sued Costa Rica for over $75 million. Which is their projected amount of income that they would make for that year. Now, Costa Rica themselves, as a country, they don't even make $75 million a year, so they wouldn't be able to pay this corporation back. And it's that kind of stipulations and laws that are absolutely inhumane to these countries.
What is the primary difference, if anything, between NAFTA and CAFTA? Is it because each of these agreements deals with particular geographic areas, but the provisions are still the same, but they pertain to different regions or countries?
Yes, they're exactly the same. The only difference is that NAFTA right now is in a stalemate. There's a lot of senators, Congress people that are against NAFTA. So what the U.S. is doing now, they're going to let that stalemate, and they are going to move on to CAFTA, which is Central American Free Trade Agreements. And if that stalls out, then they're going to move on to bilateral agreements with individual countries. The United States is extremely aggressive in wanting to have corporations move into all countries in this hemisphere so that they can prosper and be very, very powerful and make a lot of money, no matter what the hardships that they incur, with these populations.
What was the name of the conference, by the way, and was it preeminently concerned with NAFTA and CAFTA equally?
Yes, the conference itself centered around both the agreements and all the bilateral agreements that are going on in South America, because CAFTA, you know, involved with Central America. There's NAFTA, which is North America. There is the Andean agreements, which is in the Andean area of South America. And what it is like there's various different individual kind of agreements going on right now with different South American countries, just because the lawmakers are stalemating this, the passage of CAFTA. I believe CAFTA was passed in Honduras, and to my knowledge, that's the only country that so far agreed to go along with CAFTA due to extreme lobbying and bullying by the U.S. government.
That was a lead into my next question. How is it then that if these agreements are so detrimental to the native populations that the legislature of a particular country would see fit to sign on to any of these agreements? Can it be a totally voluntary act or what? Can you provide some insight on that?
Well, the information that we got from the delegates from all over the hemisphere and the reading we've done is that if a country such as, you know, Uruguay or Nicaragua decides that they do not want to be involved with CAFTA or a bilateral agreement, that the U.S. government will sanction them and will pressure them, just like they're doing in Cuba. They're having an embargo against the Cuban people. They will do pretty much the same kind of a thing to these countries. They don't want it to be worldwide knowledge that this is happening. But they will put an incredible amount of pressure on these countries. They will withhold funding that these people have been relying on for many, many years. So basically, it's just a pretty much a bullying atmosphere when it comes to these agreements. The United States does not want countries to say no, to disagree with their global imperialism that they are pressuring all other countries to be involved with.
So in essence, it's the United States government acting on behalf of really a select group of corporations, really acting almost as a global representative in this arena. I don't know whether representatives of these corporations attend these conferences or if any were present at this one, but from what I'm hearing, it sounds as though the United States government itself is the one that's acting really on behalf of the interests of the corporations that you've mentioned in pushing for these agreements.
There wasn't anybody there representing any corporations that we saw. We had a United States delegation there, and we all, of course, felt pretty bad since each and every speaker was complaining about this aggressive nature of the U.S. government. And the Canadian delegation that we became very good friends with are looked upon by these other nations as very friendly, and they work very well with each other in that area, whereas the U.S. government doesn't. And so we felt a little ashamed and felt bad that we, you know, were down there listening and trying to work with these people and trying to show them solidarity, and that we would do the best we can when we got back to spread the news to everyone about the devastation of NAFTA and CAFTA and other bilateral agreements, and to talk to our lawmakers here, see if they could change their minds and let these countries survive without our interference.
One of the questions that interests me is to what extent are other nations or regions or organizations resisting the type of changes imposed by these agreements? Can you describe for us, if you would, some of the responses that either regions or organizations or whole nations have had to the imposition of these trade agreements? In other words, what sort of resistance are we seeing out there, either locally, maybe along the seacoast or in New England or in the United States or even globally against these impositions? Because it must have come up at the conference, I'm guessing, ways to resist the onslaught, if you will.
Well, in this particular country, we do lots of letter writing, lots of calling to Washington. So these lawmakers very rarely go by a day or two without hearing from some of us in regards to our, you know, the anti-NAFTA, CAFTA resolutions. So the lawmakers here are very, very well informed of the way most of the United States citizens feel concerning NAFTA and CAFTA. It's much difficult down in South America for these peasants, hard-working campesinos, to stand up against their governments and to express the will of the farmers that, you know, they really need to stay within their culture to sustain life and to keep on growing the corn that they've been doing for all these years, and that they don't need corporations coming down there and taking advantage of these people. So they have many strikes, marches, many rallies going on in Chiapas, Mexico, and down into Bolivia and Brazil is a very active resistance to these bilateral agreements. And they are being heard. Their governments themselves are realizing that their own people are very much against it, and they are standing firm also against NAFTA and CAFTA.
The fact that the conference was held in Cuba raises an interesting question, because Cuba, as I think our listeners know, has been treated in a rather unique fashion by the United States since 1959, when Fidel Castro came to power. And there have been vicious economic embargoes imposed against Cuba. Travel restrictions are once again back in the news. The Bush administration has imposed some severe travel restrictions on travel to and from Cuba. And these are examples of the type of singular treatment that, that the United States has afforded Cuba in the last four decades or so. And I'm wondering if you could comment on that. The fact that the conference is in Cuba, I think, is significant. What was your impression of the way the United States has treated Cuba over the last several decades as it overlaps the issues that, that were raised at the conference? Because Cuba does present a special sort of circumstance, does it not?
Yes, it does. It's very interesting because they're not involved with NAFTA or CAFTA or any other bilateral agreements with the United States. They are much shunned, and the embargo is stronger now than ever. The United States is combating any country in the world that deals with Cuba. Just recently, Canada themselves have been selling jam and jellies to the United States. The U.S. just stopped that because they realized that the sugar in those products were coming from Cuba. So they decided to stop all shipments to the United States because of that alone.
Could you describe what your assessment is of the impact of this embargo on the people of Cuba?
The people of Cuba are very, very strong. They're very, very healthy. They're very alive and happy. The embargo is just one way of keeping them down and not able to really stand up and live a fuller life. Fidel has done a tremendous job in feeding all of his people, in educating all of his people, in keeping the diseases almost null and void. AIDS is basically not there. I mean, there is a small amount of that. But, I mean, if this guy was a true horrible dictator, a bad person, as Bush claims he is, why would he feed his people? Why would he educate his people? Why would he export 20,000 doctors a year to volunteer in poor countries throughout the world? It just seems to me that he could be a lot worse if that was in his heart. He does not live in a huge palace. He does not have lots of money and Rolls Royces like Batista did, the former dictator of Cuba. Fidel lives very modestly. His job is to keep the people of Cuba healthy and educated and happy as much as possible. If the embargo was lifted, it would provide these people with some of the things that they're not able to get right now, and that's some food products, some medicines that the U.S. is really hurting Cuba by not selling them these medicines unless they pay U.S. cash only, which makes it very difficult since there's not a lot of U.S. cash in Cuba, and the U.S. knows that. So the tighter they screw the screws onto Cuba, the happier the administration in Washington is. They are spending, I think, upwards to like about $100 million on the dissidents in Cuba and trying to promote the overthrow. They are well prepared for the new government that's going to be coming in as soon as Fidel is ousted, as soon as the CIA can possibly get rid of him. They've been trying for 50 years to get rid of him, and they would be very happy if they could do this. And then the new government from Miami would probably come in, and it would be a horrible, horrible bloodbath if that ever happened.
There hasn't yet been a formal declaration of war against Cuba, but in essence, with the embargoes and the sort of internal interference in internal affairs that you've described here somewhat, are we on the brink of a conflict with Cuba? Are we close to that? I mean, it sounds as though we're at the doorstep as it is, as far as going to the next level. I'm reminded of the case of the Cuban Five, which I'm hoping maybe you can comment on in a second, as an example of the way in which the real perpetrators of injustice are not brought to justice, and in fact, people who are trying to fight and struggle for other people, as the Cuban Five are known to have done, they're the ones who are actually imprisoned and persecuted for trying to really bring world attention to this whole state of affairs.
Extremely disheartening to see, you know, the government of the United States focused primarily on the overthrow of Fidel Castro. It seems like we're quite busy in the Middle East right now and in other parts of the world, and for some reason the U.S. will not give up a minute on their overthrow of Cuba. And the number one reason why they want to overthrow Cuba is for trade only. It has nothing to do with human rights or religious freedom, nothing like that at all. It's strictly trade. So I hope that someday Cuba is not filled with Nike and McDonald's, Burger King's, and all of these other horrible corporations that the United States is filled with, since we know that, you know, none of them are very healthy anyway. But to get back to the United States attack on Cuba, it's relentless. It's ongoing. They have an airplane flying over Cuba 24 hours a day, bombarding the Cuban citizens with lies about Fidel and the, you know, the Cuban government. The Cuban people in Miami are the only people that are keeping the U.S. from attacking Cuba right now. They don't want the U.S. to attack Cuba because it would be a very horrible bloodbath. Many, many, you know, citizens would be killed, plus many of the family members from these Cuban Americans would be killed. So that's the last thing they want. I mean, they would love to have a CIA assassination of Fidel. They would like to have all the speedboats zip over from Miami and take over the, you know, the country in that manner. And that way there'd be less amount of deaths, probably. But it goes on and on. It goes, you know, they're paying these dissidents lots of money in Cuba to make a lot of problems for Fidel. Just recently, he arrested 75 of these well-paid dissidents. The U.S. government was paying them. Their relatives were paying them from Miami. They were living a wonderful life in Cuba, and they were organizing, and they were spreading rumors that it's time to take over. Well, Fidel arrested them, just as Bush would do the same thing if I was getting money from the Iraqi government to overthrow this country. So that's the first thing anybody would do, would be to put those people in jail because you don't want to have your country overthrown. So that's what he did. And some people have been crying, oh, he's arresting Christians. Some of the people just happened to be Christians, but Christianity had nothing to do with the reason why they were put in jail. They were well-paid dissidents.
Well, that's a view that's very different from what we hear in the mainstream U.S. media, which simply reports that Fidel Castro's repressive regime has tossed into jail any number of dissidents for expressing their political views. But the story you cast here right now in that connection is very different indeed. I know we hinted at a moment before about the case of the Cuban Five, and I'm wondering if you could recite to our listeners a little bit about this case is and why it's so important, not only to obviously to the individuals involved, but to the role of the United States in international relations and the role of international law and the pursuit of justice that this country purports to be engaged in. This case turns justice on its head, it seems, and it embodies all the issues I think that we've talked about, issues of self-determination, issues of justice. Can you describe for a bit, if you would, the case of the Cuban Five and perhaps where we stand in connection with that case today?
Living in Miami right now, there are 5 to 6 well-known terrorist organizations that have been attempting to overthrow the government of Cuba with the help of the U.S. government. They've been in operation for many years down there. They have bombed Cuban airplanes, Cuban hotels. They've assassinated diplomatic members of the Cuban government throughout the world. And Fidel sent 5 Cubans up to Miami to find out more about what these terrorist organizations were planning on doing. So they infiltrated these terrorist organizations. So Fidel sent these people up here to infiltrate these terrorist groups, and they did, and they found out a lot of information about upcoming terrorist acts against Cuba. So these 5 Cubans reported this information to the FBI. In retrospect, that was a huge mistake because the FBI turned around and arrested these people, put them in solitary confinement for 17 months in Miami. After the trial in Miami, which was a very strange venue for the trial since everybody in Miami are all Cuban and they're all friends with these terrorists, they wanted these people to be locked up forever. And that is just what happened to these five people. Two or three of them were sentenced to life imprisonment plus 18 or 20 years after that life imprisonment. And the other one's 15 to 20 years. So these people are unjustly persecuted by the U.S. government. They were there to help the FBI find out what these people were doing. At this moment, Mr. Carias is currently in Miami living, and he is a world-famous terrorist. He is the one behind the bombing of the airplane, and the U.S. government knows he's in Miami, and he's seeking asylum. As Bush said, any country harboring terrorists are terrorists themselves. Now, he's got to look in the mirror and realize that his country is harboring many, many terrorists in Miami, and he thinks that that's a good thing because these guys are terrorists for overthrowing Cuba. But in fact, is a terrorist is a terrorist. If you kill innocent people anywhere in the world, you're a terrorist. And so this particular man with his friends are living in Miami now seeking asylum. And if the U.S. government grants them asylum, Bush and his administration are going to have to deal with that contradiction.
Michael, I'm wondering, and just getting back to topics we've raised earlier, particularly with respect to the conference and any other issues that we've raised today, are there any concluding thoughts or remarks that you would like to leave the listening audience with today, something that you'd like them to take note of as a result of your experience of the conference and in terms of some of the issues that we've raised and discussed today?
Well, basically, I really want to say that the war on Cuba, the very first thing that dies is the truth. And the U.S. government has changed every single bit of truth coming out of Cuba. Cuba's accomplishments, they've developed a meningitis B, hepatitis B vaccine, and AIDS drugs, and therapeutic lung cancer vaccines. And the U.S. government is claiming none of them work and that they're lies. Well, the fact is that they have the best medical care of any country in the hemisphere. There's no reason for the U.S. to lie about this. I mean, you know, all they care about is the overthrow of the Cuban government for their own trade purposes. The U.S. government has no other reason to overthrow Cuba. They loved it when Batista was there because they could travel down there and do their drugs and have their prostitutes, and the mob down there was, everybody was all connected. It was a lot of fun, except the Cuban people were starving and dying. Now that Fidel cares so much and took over his country, he's feeding all of his people, he's educating all his people, and he's giving them a wonderful health care program. And I think that the world needs to know that whatever you hear from the U.S. government concerning Cuba is a 100% lie. And that if you don't believe me, then travel down to Cuba, check for yourself the happiness and the health of these people and these children, and you'll see for yourself that it's a wonderful country. We need to protect them and to keep U.S. intervention out of Cuba.
Michael, I want to thank you once again for the insights that you've lent to our audience with respect to your experience in Cuba at the recent conference. And I want to thank you once again for the insights you've provided with respect to the Cuban perspective. And again, I would encourage all our listeners to make it their business to educate themselves on the issues of NAFTA and CAFTA and to take whatever appropriate action they deem necessary to remedy the worst effects of those provisions by urging the United States to renege on the agreements entirely or to take whatever other effective action they deem appropriate. Michael, I want to thank you once again for being our guest today on Making Waves, and I thank you for appearing.
Thank you very much.
For the moment, the horizon is on fire, democracy rising, bounced on a wire, liberation. You can smell it in the air, things are moving, and the rich are all aware. Some will talk along the sidelines, others they will do. Sing a song for Chavez before the coup. Are alive on the radio. The barrio
heroes have arrived, Cuban doctors, in their thousands on the street, in the shanty towns. They're pouring the concrete. The opposition whines that Venezuela is all through. Sing a song for Chavez before the coup. Before the moon, folks are learning how to read the Constitution. Is the people's creed from their back pocket? They'll take it out for all to see, and their motto is death or liberty. There are those who will complain, mostly the privileged few. Sing a song for Chavez before the coup. For the moment, the oil wells are flowing and sickles profits. Know exactly where they're going, feed the hungry. House those without a home, give the tractors to those who dig sod and loam. Maybe he will meet the fate that I end a new. But I'll sing a song for Chavez before the coup. For the moment, the movement's on the rise, it's all happening right before our eyes. But turn on the TV, and there's nothing they will say. If he's gone and we don't hear it, did it happen anyway? If the future's to be ours, I ask, what are you gonna do? Sing a song for Chavez before the coup. Sing a song for Chavez before the coup. Sing a song for Chavez before the coup.
I grew up in a company town. I worked real hard till that company closed down. They gave my job to another man on half my wages in some foreign land. And when I asked, how could that be any good for our economy, I was told nobody cares so long as they make money when they sell their shares. Can you hear us? Are you listening? No power without accountability. Yeah. I lost my job, my car, and my house. Went 10,000 miles away, some guy clicked on a mouse. He didn't know me, we never spoke. He didn't ask my opinion or canvas my votes. I guess it's true, nobody cares till those petrol bombs come spinning through the air. Gotta find a way to hold them to account before they find a way to snuff our voices out. Can you hear us? Are you listening? No power without accountability. Ballot box is no guarantee that we achieve democracy. Our leaders claim their victory when we have the people spoken. There is no job security in this global economy. Our borders close to refugees, but our markets forced open. Bank says to Mexico, we'll cut you off if you don't keep your taxes low. They have no right to wield that sword. They take their orders from the chairman of the board. IMF, WTO, I hear these
words just every place I go. Who are these people who elected them? And how do I replace them with some of my friends? Hey, yeah. Are you listening? No power without accountability. Are you listening? No power without accountability. Are you listening? No power without accountability.
That was David Rovics with Song for Hugo Chavez, followed by Billy Bragg with No Power Without Accountability. We'll now hear some commentary from Steve Diamond.
Next, we have a column that was posted on NHIMC called Foreign Fighters in Iraq by nhcatsteve@yahoo.com. Clearly, the ongoing and perhaps permanent war on terrorism has gained the interest of many foreigners willing to seek their fortunes and risk their lives on the dangerous streets of Iraq. Some apparently are motivated by religious fervor and a sense of Arab nationalism. Others are fighting in Iraq for money and in the hopes of earning U.S. citizenship. U.S. public relations officers, many deeply embedded in the corporate media establishment, claim that only about 1,600 U.S. soldiers have been killed, despite years of intense guerrilla warfare resisting the U.S. occupation of Iraq. Propaganda videos released by their counterparts in the Iraqi resistance claim that most of the American casualties are Central American mercenaries, used by the Pentagon as shock troops and quickly buried in mass graves when killed. It's certainly possible that both of these extreme spins on the situation are true, since they are not mutually exclusive. We can only examine the facts and available evidence to extrapolate which narrative is more true. The claims by the resistance regarding mass graves have a certain inherent worthless credibility, since clearly mass graves of some sort have been found in Iraq, and conveniently this also casts doubt on the numbers of Iraqi dissidents sent to mass graves by Saddam Hussein. Other than careful analysis of satellite imagery, the extreme danger of fact-checking in Iraq makes the assertions of the resistance hard to verify. The claims by the U.S. military are also nearly impossible to verify independently. The invasions and occupation of Iraq have been handled with unprecedented control of the media, including forcing American media to be embedded with U.S. soldiers and literally shooting and bombing unfriendly journalists and destroying their offices. Some newspaper publishers in liberated Iraq have been forced to stop printing by the U.S. military. The key to the truth may be a matter of definition. We know that the three Americans killed and suspended from a bridge in Fallujah were technically civilian contractors. They worked for a U.S. security firm called Blackwater USA, hired by the U.S. Occupation Authority to escort its officials in Iraq. In other words, these contractors were heavily armed and highly trained mercenaries. U.S. officials will only say that about 25,000 contractors are working in Iraq in support of the U.S. military, but won't clarify exactly what roles they serve, what countries they come from, or what compensation is promised. Colombian paramilitary forces are even being hired to defend Iraq's oil infrastructure. The Iraqi resistance appears to be quite skilled and carefully equipped, as Saddam Hussein proudly claimed from his cell. Given the historical effectiveness of guerrilla warfare tactics and the continuous nature of major attacks on U.S. forces by the resistance, it's hard to imagine that the 1,600 American soldiers killed in action so far is an accurate representation of what is happening in Iraq. Like Enron sending its debt offshore, the Bush administration has demonstrated an extraordinary ability to concoct obfuscating truths to hide incipient crises. In the money game that is modern warfare, the best evidence we have that the war in Iraq is not going well may be the administration's blasé attitude towards impending economic collapse. Given the federal budget, national debt, trade deficit, Social Security and Medicare crises, and the enduring reliance of the American economy on foreign oil, the administration seems to almost be saying, "Don't worry, we have a secret plan to make oil cheap and abundant for Americans once again." But the Iraqis don't seem eager to cooperate. So-called major combat in Iraq was declared over years ago, yet the war clearly rages on. The Iraqi resistance and the foreign jihadists have vast weapons caches and can operate with hardly any funding, while the high-tech U.S. Army and its mercenaries require an incredible amount of financial support. Something has to give, and while the so-called war on terrorism may be permanent, the occupation of Iraq cannot last forever. Vietnam proved that a guerrilla force can suffer huge casualties, lose all major battles, and continue to operate with vastly inferior weapons until the occupying army is eventually forced to make an ungraceful withdrawal. Once again, that's a commentary on nhindymedia.org, and there are several citations you can check out by going to their website and clicking on commentaries on the right bar.